Morning, everyone. The hour of 8:15 has arrived, and kind of call to order the meeting of Labor Workplace and Regulated Industries. And Representative Simon, would you be willing to move minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
The minutes have been moved. Any discussion of the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved for February 27th. Members, we have a full agenda today that we're going to address. And we're going to start right off with Representative Moline. Is he here? I saw. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Welcome. Let me, before we get started, Representative, the Chair moves that House File 2300 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And I don't see you don't have any amendments, so if you want to just go ahead and present your bill, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I do have a few testifiers with me today, so I know that you want to move through kind of quickly with your full agenda. So the bill basically adds some additional protections to the Minnesota Human Rights Act, the definitions of a status of a family caregiver and familial status. And if you'll notice in the bill, family caregiver is defined because it's not defined elsewhere in statute. And it means a person who cares for another person related by blood, marriage, or legal custody, or with whom the person lives in a familial relationship. Familial status isn't defined in this bill because it is defined elsewhere in statute in 363A.03. And members, the reason I brought this bill forward is we're seeing more and more cases of people who have status of a caregiver who spend their, have a sick loved one, whether that be a spouse or a child who they need to care for at home and are having to take some time off work in order to do that. And they're finding difficulties gaining and maintaining employment because of their status of a caregiver. And so we wanted to provide some additional protections for those people in the areas of employment so they can maintain their jobs while still caring for their loved one. So I know we have a couple people here to testify if we want to bring them forward at this time.
Would the testifiers move towards the table? That'd be great.
Hello.
Welcome, and if you would just be so kind as to identify yourself.
Sure.
And then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I direct the Center on Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota. And I also lead a partnership with the Women's Foundation of Minnesota looking at the status of women and girls in the state of Minnesota. And today I wanted to share some information about the role of caregiver discrimination, also known as family responsibility discrimination, and the role that that plays in women's economic inequality. So caregiver discrimination is employment discrimination against workers based on the knowledge that that employee has family caregiving responsibilities. Employees may be passed over for hire or promotion, harassed or terminated, or otherwise penalized, now this is really important, despite good performance, because their employers make personnel decisions based on stereotypical notions or assumptions about how an employee with caregiving responsibilities will or should act given those family responsibilities. Now, while EEO claims for other forms of discrimination have fallen, those related to family responsibility or caregiver discrimination have increased by 400%. Demographic realities, including an aging workforce and population and increasing workforce participation of women, suggest this will continue. These claims include both women and men who are increasingly stepping up to take on their fair share of caregiving responsibilities and stepping outside of our gendered norms about who does caregiving and who does work outside the home. Today, the majority of Minnesota workers have some caregiving responsibilities outside of work. 79% of Minnesota mothers with children under six work outside the home. And that's up there in terms of, we're way ahead of the national average in terms of that. Caregiving discrimination can have an especially devastating impact on women's economic security. The motherhood penalty on earnings is estimated by some studies to be around 7% after controlling for things like time in the workforce and other factors. Mothers who are forced to take breaks from their workforce participation often lose ground economically, returning to jobs at lower salaries than the ones they left. Women of color and low-income women in Minnesota and nationally are more likely to have unpaid caregiving responsibilities and also are more likely to work in the service occupations which are most commonly represented in caregiver discrimination cases. 63% of African American, 62% of American Indian, and 57% of Latino women in Minnesota work in sales and service. Now, the bill before you today does not require special treatment for caregivers, just that they receive the same opportunities as all other employees. The approach taken in this bill, adding caregiver and familial status to the Human Rights Act's employment protections, is one that over 60 localities have had in place for many years, including the city of St. Paul. St. Paul Human Rights Department staff say that the inclusion is helpful for families but has not been a large burden for businesses. They see around 10 claims per year. Washington, D.C.'s similar ordinance has resulted in around 20 claims per year. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Lisa Stratton. Nope, okay. Mary Jo, we'll go next.
Oh, thank you, Rob.
Here.
Ms. Fitzpatrick, we'll move on to the next testifier. Members, just for your information about process, what we'll do is we'll hear, get the presentation of the author from the bill, listen to the testifiers, then open up for questions from members. So that's kind of the lay of the land and how we'll proceed. And you'd identify yourself and...
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning and would like to thank Representative Moline for authoring this very important legislation. As you heard from Deb Fitzpatrick, House File 2300 will make it clear that an employer may not discriminate against an employee for family caregiving responsibilities by adding family caregiver to the list of protected categories under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. As both the population and the labor force ages, more and more workers are having to provide elder care responsibilities. Caring for an older relative is now the new normal of family caregiving. Some other statistics that are important is today we know that 42% of U.S. workers provide elder care in the past 5 years, and just under half of the workforce expects to be providing elderly care for a family member or friend. In Minnesota, 1 in 6 caregivers are providing care for their aging parents or loved one. This changing demographic is creating the potential for greater discrimination on the job and underscores the need for this legislation. Some additional examples of caregiver discrimination include penalizing family caregivers for requesting time off or taking job protected leave to which they are entitled. Or it may be sending the message that caring for a parent is not an adult child's responsibility. In one case we heard of, an employee was denied leave when her employer asserted that it's not her responsibility to care for her ailing mother as long as her father is alive. Without equal opportunity, family caregivers risk losing their status as trusted workers or even their jobs due to bias against them. And we also know the financial impact on working caregivers who leave the workforce earlier can be severe. It is estimated that family caregivers aged 50 years of age or older who leave the workforce due to caregiving on average lose $304,000 in wages and benefits over their lifetime. So in conclusion, I think as you already heard, policies like this are important to help caregivers on the job, but it doesn't provide for any additional rights. Rather, it would simply require employers to treat workers with caregiving responsibilities the same way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. George, for your testimony. Ms. Stratton and around here? I don't see here.
Mr. Chair, we can go to questions.
Does anyone else want?
She's here.
Representative Moline?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I said we could go to questions. I don't see that Ms. Stratton.
Did anyone else want to testify on the bill first off? Seeing none, we'll move to to questions from members, and start off with Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Moline, for bringing this forward, and congratulations. It looks like you're going to have a baby soon. So
thank you.
It's very exciting and very apropos for bringing this bill forward. You know, and I know that you're a lawyer, and so I was just, the question really is for you. I believe the author. Can you let us know really what's covered in federal law and how this is it duplicative or is it different? Can you explain that a little bit?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. Our other testifier is here, and I believe she's the one that would know the answer to that. I'm not sure what is in federal law as far as the family caregiver status goes, but it looks like Ms. Fitzpatrick knows the answer.
Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Mr. Chair, member Representative O'Neill, there is currently nothing in federal law that prohibits caregiver discrimination. There are other types of protections that sometimes these types of claims can come under. For example, sex discrimination or the ADA. And Lisa Stratton can talk a little bit about the gaps and how some of the cases do not fit that profile or would not be eligible to come under those types of protections. But there is no specific caregiver discrimination protections in federal law currently.
Representative Keeper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, last year we had a Hansen bill that dealt with the family leave and expanded what we can cover and what employers should be able to cover for the employees. And we're even amending that this year to make sure that the teachers are covered because it said something about 12-month employment, and now we're changing it to 9-month employment. So I don't see what's the purpose of this. It sounds like we've already taken care of this a lot already.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kiefer. If I remember correctly on the Hansen bill that we passed into law, that had to do with if an employee had already accumulated a certain amount of sick time, they were able to use that sick time in order to care for a sick family member. This bill adds the family caregiver and familial status to the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which means people can't be discriminated against in hiring or promotion or discharged because of their status as a caregiver. So I think it's two different things. This has more to do with the protection for the employee based on their status.
Representative Kiefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. All right, so then if it's before they're employed and there's an interview going on, is there going to be an obligation to disclose that information so the employer has that information before they make the decision to hire that person? And if so, and they disclose it and still don't get the job, is that, and maybe it's not why they got the job, but is that a huge potential for more lawsuits down the road?
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiefer, thanks for the question. Actually, under the Human Rights Act, the employer can't ask what your status would be as a caregiver. Just like under the current Human Rights Act, they can't ask you what your religion is or if you're married. There's a couple other questions that employers can't ask, and this would be included. So the employer would be prevented from saying, are you a family caregiver? Do you provide care to your parent or grandparent or child or something like that? So that's part of the Minnesota Human Rights Act now, and again, we're just adding those two other protections.
Representative Buchlum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I have a little question. First of all, I'd like to preface this by saying I think overall, this is probably a pretty good bill, but I'm concerned about some of the definitions, for instance, family caregiver, and how broad they are. You know, like particularly item 2 there, for whom the person lives in a familial relationship. That seems pretty broad to me. You know, businesses are going to have to comply with this, and having real concise definitions will make life a lot easier for businesses and avoid any misconceptions or problems. Also, on number 1, we say who was related by blood, marriage, or legal custody. Now that, when I'm reading that, would you be able to include a son or daughter from a previous marriage in that particular definition or not?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, I believe that. Are you talking about a stepchild or?
Right. I mean, they're not by blood, but you know, they might be by marriage, possibly, but not right now. You know.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that's why we had the paragraph 2 with whom the person lives in a familial relationship. So somebody who would be quote unquote family, but maybe not by the exact definition of blood or marriage at that time. And the reason we tried to expand the definition under family caregiver is because the current definition under familial status really only applies to a child under the age of 18, and the parent has to have custody of that child. So like a non-custodial father wouldn't have the same protections as a custodial mother would as far as giving care to the child. So that's why we tried to expand it in the family caregiver status to make sure that, you know, when we do have blended families, that those parents have the same protections that other families do.
Mr. Chair, are you going?
Yeah, I guess I understand that, but, you know, there's really no definition, precise definition of familial relationship in this bill. And I'm just concerned that when employers are looking at this and deciding, you know, how to comply and if there's a problem and things, I just think that the definitions could be tightened up on this. For instance, a son or daughter from a previous marriage could be 2 or 3 times removed. You know, I mean, that's the way our society is nowadays, and they're probably not living within the family and things like that. I'm just concerned that if employers are going to have to comply with this law, that we should have the very most concise definitions that we possibly can. So if we could work on that, I think it would be good.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So just kind of a follow-up with the same discussion. Am I understand then we're adding family caregiver to the Human Rights Act? And are there any other states that have added this particular status? Because if I remember correctly, the Human Rights Act says gender, sexual orientation, race, race and religion. But family caregiver doesn't quite fit those categories. So is there any other state in the nation that's adding this to their Human Rights Act?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deb Fitzpatrick. Alaska has a provision for familial status, and then as I mentioned in my testimony, over 60 local governments have it, including the city of St. Paul. Their definitions vary, going to the point made earlier, but many of them use familial status broadly defined. For instance, in the situation of St. Paul, they use the term familial status in their statute or in their ordinance, but they define that as both being a parent as well as other caregiving kinds of situations.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To either testifier, well, in an example that from a question earlier, we already can't ask questions during the interview process regarding marital status and family and kids and anything like that. So I'm wondering, in terms of that kind of satisfies the employment issue, or it should at least. I mean, there would already be an avenue for a person with a complaint to seek redress of that. And so I'm wondering, from the standpoint of now I'm employed, where does family medical leave come in that it would, in fact, help cover, you know, here's 12 weeks of unpaid leave that's guaranteed, and where does that come in to help provide the level of protection that you're looking for?
If you want to identify yourself first and then answer the question.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lisa Stratton. I'm an attorney and the executive director of Gender Justice. And I think the answer to your question is the distinction between statutes like the FMLA, the Family and Medical Leave Act, that require employers to accommodate, in certain situations, and they're limited and probably not worth going through all the limits on it. But this statute would simply mean that employers can't discriminate. So in other words, it doesn't require them to take any particular action. They don't have to accommodate. They don't have to provide time off. They don't have to do anything unless that's their normal practice. So unless they're denying you the ability to have time off that they give other employees out of a judgment, an assumption, or a stereotype about your level of commitment, say, because you're a caretaker.
Representative Benson?
Well, in fact, that statute, FEM Medical Leave Act, would provide redress for an employee who feels like they've been violated in that way. I didn't get my time off, and simply because I was a caregiver. I mean, it doesn't give you the latitude. It says you will get the time off if you meet with this criteria. So kind of understanding, paint me a scenario where you believe we see, I mean, there was an example, I think the stat was 20 cases. You know, I don't know if that's a big number or a little number. It sounds, if that's a national number, fairly small. Okay, but nevertheless, I mean, paint me a scenario where it doesn't cover, I mean, where family medical leave, and there's already a number of things on the books, including our own laws that cover discrimination. So I have other problems, and people have brought up some of the similar issues in terms of the broad term of familial, but if you could just address that.
Ms. Stratton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To that question?
The difference is that the prevention of discrimination or prohibition of discrimination means you can't treat someone differently in, say, promotion or transfer or raises. You know, the normal workplace conditions, the terms and conditions of employment are what the Minnesota Human Rights Act covers. I'll give you an example. And this happens very frequently. Sales positions. Say a woman is in a sales position, she has a child, she's up for promotion. Nothing about her performance changed, but now she's not going to be offered the promotion based on the assumption that she now doesn't want to travel. Without asking her, without finding out if that's true, based on a stereotype about her caregiving duties at home that should just be outside the workplace.
Representative Mehta?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, testifiers and Representative Moline, for bringing what I see a good bill forward. One thing I kind of wanted to point out in a big picture would be I think some of this protection would be not after the fact and what recourse we can seek, but more so you shouldn't feel guilty and miss an opportunity with a family member when it might be your last time with them or, you know, whatever the case may be. And this would put the protection in front, knowing that you could go out and take that time without the recourse afterwards. So I just wanted to say that.
Thank you,
Representative Benson.
Representative Moline, final comment to your bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify, and I think the testifier just did that. I think we're talking about two different things when we're talking about the Family Medical Leave Act or sick leave, and we're talking about this bill. This more so has to do with the discrimination aspects of employment, promotion, other job opportunities that would be prevented because of your status as a family caregiver. And I also wanted to point out to the committee, excuse me, in regards to the actual definition, so just so you know, under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, the burden is on the employee or plaintiff to sort of prove that they were discriminated against. So they would have to prove that they meet that definition. They would have to prove that they were discriminated against. That burden is not on the employer. So those protections are in place currently under law.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Moline. Representative Benson?
So one last question. The scenario that you painted in terms of, you know, the person who didn't get asked for the job, my assumption is in that case that you as a lawyer bring a suit against that employer because of gender already in the current situation. So my line of question is simply, do we already have the protections that you seek by adding these already in existence in law, and are we making the law overly complicated now by adding, a definition familial that may be difficult But in that case that you painted, simply that person would have a lawsuit just on gender. Is that not correct?
Ms. Stratton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it's correct that you could bring such a lawsuit, but they often lose. It's very difficult to prove sex discrimination. You have to prove the connection between gender and the assumption. And that's not always easy. I gave you a case, and you're correct, in which maybe that would be, you know, that's one I might take, because you possibly could win on that one. But when we're talking about the greater range of caregiving, like especially elder care, I think men are going to need, often will need leave for, not leave, but should be allowed to take time from work for that without being discriminated against or the next promotion or raise withheld. So it's not creating additional abilities to do that, just to keep the negative consequence to the employee for having done it.
Representative Nelson, to a point, and then we're going to move to the vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess it's just a point I want to make. I think I want to make here. This, there's nothing in this language that says it's for women only. I know I have a nephew, or my niece has children, and her husband's the one that stays home as the caregiver. This has nothing to do with what it's just for women. It's for everybody that has that position, and I guess that's the only point I want to make, because it seems like the discussion I've been hearing here this morning, it's all about women and not the fact that there are men that are in this position also.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. The chair renews his motion that House File 2300 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? A motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Moline. Off to civil law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I think I saw Representative Yaruso arrive. Representative Yaruso, I'll go ahead and move that House File 2259 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. So, welcome, Representative Yaruso, if you'd be so good as to present your bill, and then we'll take some time from your testifier and then move on to members' questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill deals with accommodations for nursing mothers that need to pump breast milk during their workday. We already have a statute that provides for reasonable accommodations in that case. However, the statute does not have any teeth to it. There's no enforcement mechanism, and so people that have experienced difficulties with their employers have had to sue them on their own to get recourse. The statute also clarifies what type of accommodations are preferred for this. It already mentioned that it should be a room or other location close to the work area that, other than a bathroom stall, it adds other than a bathroom or toilet stall, and that is shielded from view and free from intrusion from coworkers and the public, and that includes access to an electrical outlet. And then it provides that a violation of this section is an unfair employment practice as provided for under Section 363A.08, Subdivision 8. So that cross-references the enforcement mechanism in the Human Rights Act. I have some personal experience with these situations myself. I've got three kids, and I breastfed all three of them, and I pumped milk at work with all three of them. In one case, I had some really wonderful accommodations. That employer was fairly large, and so they were able to offer using one of the rooms down in the nurse's office. In the second case, it wasn't quite as large an employer, so they didn't have a nurse like that. And in that case, my first offer was a toilet stall, which I had to explain was not particularly appropriate when you're dealing with a food product for your infant. So I finally found a room that I could use. It did not have a functioning lock on the door, so I would have to physically barricade the door every day when I went in there. But still, I was more fortunate in having that available than many people are in their experience. I'm responsible for adding the words electrical outlet, because having been through this myself and having a daughter who's been through this herself, There are a variety of kinds of pumps out there, and people find that different ones work best for them. And some of these require electricity. And so that's why that was added to it. Thank you. And now I would like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome again, Ms. Stratton. I assume you're here for take questions, but you have some testimony as well?
Very briefly, I thought I would just share what brought this to light for me as an attorney and executive director of Gender Justice, where we learn about many of the barriers to women in the workplace by getting calls from women who are experiencing them and seeking help. We represent some of those women and men, and we have represented a woman named Tara Duncan, who faced exactly this situation, worked for an employer, it was a small employer, who had previously accommodated her need, you know, to have some short breaks and to pump, and she was extremely careful about not doing it in such a way as to interfere. She was going to answer phones and do things at the same time. And this time her employer told her, no, I don't have to. I don't have 50 employees, so I don't have to. Well, he wasn't correct, and he fired her. He wasn't correct because of this state law that Senator Ellen Anderson, I think, was behind in 1998. So we've had it for a long time. But people are coming forward and saying, my employer isn't following it. And if the employer, so we went to our statute book, we've got a law on that. I know we do in Minnesota. We've had it for years. There's no enforcement mechanism at all, which creates a very unclear situation for employers and employees alike. So one of the goals of this overall package is to equalize the playing field for men and women in the workplace and to provide the ability for employees to do basic things that are required of them as caregivers. And just wanted to share her story.
Right. And is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify? Come on up to the stand and go ahead and identify yourself and
certainly.
Proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Melissa Rafan, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Employment Law Council, which is a group of the state's largest employers. I am general counsel to that group. And with respect to this nursing mother's law, I would point out two things. The first is that essentially what the law does is expands the employer's obligation to provide space, and I'm not here to speak on that issue. If people want to have electrical cords, MELC is not here to say they shouldn't. What is very, very important, though, is that this committee understand that the grafting of one statute onto another is unprecedented and very problematic. The remedy that is being proposed is to bring this within the Minnesota Human Rights Act, 363A.08, which is a statute designed to prevent intentional discrimination. The Nursing Mothers Act is simply to expand the physical space allowed for a woman to pump milk during the day. To move that to the Minnesota Human Rights Act is very problematic and, again, unprecedented. And I think all of us played that game when we were little where you have a body, you have a head, you have a middle, you have a bottom, and you flip and you do a mix and match. That's essentially what we're doing here. We're mixing apples and oranges. If there is no remedy under the Nursing Mothers Act, which is in Chapter 181, then an appropriate remedy may be to have an alternative dispute resolution in that section. Every other section of Chapter 181 provides for a violation in that section and is not tied to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And to tie it to this Minnesota Human Rights Act, which prohibits intentional discrimination, is inappropriate. Just as I would like to just simply add, because I was not given an opportunity to address the family caregiver statute, on the family caregiver statute, a very important point was made by a gentleman who said, isn't that really to protect men as well as women? And the answer is, the family caregiver statute is not necessary because we already have the protection under exactly the point that was made, the gender discrimination provision of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Familial status is a very problematic, amorphous term, which if added to the Human Rights Act, which will frankly be a winner for the lawyers, and they're the only ones who will win. So I thank you very much. Are there any questions, Mr. Chair?
Thank you for testimony. We will get into questions shortly. But Ms. Stratton, did you want to answer to any of the concerns raised?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to address the choice of enforcement mechanism that was raised. Yes, when you're looking to add an enforcement mechanism to an existing statute, you have to figure out where it's going to go and what it's going to be. And looking at the remedial schemes in the Chapter 181, they are rather random and ad hoc. Each statute has a different one. It did not seem to make sense to try to craft an entirely new scheme when we have one that works fairly well, that allows for the bringing of a charge of discrimination rather than going straight to litigation, and would let then the department mediate. I have spoken with the department about it, and I raised the very question that my colleague did about is this unprecedented, and the answer was no, it is not. The Ban the Box legislation pointed also at the Human Rights Act, and they are now enforcing that, so it is not unprecedented to have another chapter point to the Human Rights Act as its remedial scheme.
Very good. Questions from members at this point? Seeing none, Representative Keeper?
And this is just following kind of sure. The same line, but I actually had a note on here, and in this 363A.08, I just wrote a note, expand on this. Can you tell us what would be the penalty then? If this bill were to pass and there's a violation, what's the consequence to the employer and the business?
Well, Ms. Bratton?
I think the question you're asking is really a good one, because the bill, the nursing mother's bill, certainly says there should be a remedy if an employer does not comply with a space requirement. And it appears that the remedy most appropriately would be a remedy right in that statute where the employee makes a demand, and then perhaps there's an alternative dispute resolution right there. Ms. Stratton's point that 181 is a patchwork of different remedies could be revised to simply say 181 has remedies tailored to the violation at issue. 363.08, the Minnesota Human Rights Act, allows people to either bring a charge with the Department of Human Rights or go directly to court. And if people are allowed to go directly to court for a violation of 181, we are going to open the floodgates of litigation, which is completely inappropriate for that statute. That statute provides for punitive damages, it provides for wage loss, and failure to provide an electrical cord does not entitle someone to wage loss, right? It's simply fix it, get us the electrical cord. And the best way to remedy that statute is to have a narrowly tailored remedy for a violation of that statute in that statute.
Thank you, Mr. Fan. Representative Mehta?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just wondering, do you have any statistics that or projections that would show what the floodgate would be and how many of these people would come out the woodwork to file lawsuits?
Mr. Fan, please.
What I can say, Mr. Chair, in response to the question is, or representative, in response to the question is simply this. Having litigated on behalf of employers for over 25 years, I can tell you that every opportunity to bring an amorphous claim raises the prospects of litigation. Now, I think the point that I made really is the point to focus on, and that is I am not suggesting there be no remedy. I'm simply saying it should be part of the statute which talks about the violation. And opening up the Minnesota Department of Human Rights as a remedy for a violation that an employer fails to put in an electrical cord or give someone adequate space is inappropriate and is an apples to oranges remedy.
Very good. And I think this matter is going to civil law too, so there'll be some time to work out. I don't hear a lot of concerns about the policy aspect, but we're not going to litigate between you two attorneys where this is going to go and all this sort of thing, so I don't want to drag this on forever. But Representative Nelson, you had a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I heard the witness keep saying electric cord. The way I read the bill, it says an electrical outlet. There's nothing that says about an electric cord, and maybe it's just a semantics, but an electrical outlet in the room doesn't seem to be that onerous. I think that would fall under reasonable accommodations anyway. I guess that's just the only point I'd make.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Russo?
I'm glad you brought up the phrase reasonable accommodations, because the paragraph begins with employer must make reasonable efforts to provide. And so the statute recognizes that there are cases in which that's not possible. And so we don't really need to go into a whole litany of cases where it's not possible to do so. And we have not changed that in this.
Good. Well, it sounds like Mr. Fan, Mr. Stratton, maybe you could spend some time talking about the legal aspects of this matter and how it could best work out in terms of good policy. One last question from Representative Simonson, and move to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine will be very short, and I don't want to get into the legal aspects, but the policy, I'm a little bit confused. I completely understand where you're coming from and completely support the concept. And I completely understand current law that talks about other than a toilet stall. But I don't understand the addition of the word bathroom, because I don't know what the definition of bathroom is. And I think about the place that I work, okay? We have separate facilities for men and for women. And I know that we refer to it as a locker room, but there are bathroom facilities in there, there are shower facilities in there, there are changing areas, there are sitting areas. It seems like in the past, as I think back, that has been used for this particular purpose. And just assure me that that's not going to be prohibited should we pass this into law, that room could be used by the individual should she choose to use it.
Maybe Ms. Stratton, is that your question, or Ms. Russo, Representative Russo?
I don't see any, I'm not a lawyer, let's start with that, but I don't see any language in here that would suggest that if the employee is amenable to that wouldn't be okay. And personally, it would completely depend on the circumstances, because there are varying degrees of how private and how quiet such an area would be, depending on the place. So if, for example, you were talking about this building, the public women's bathrooms would not be a particularly okay place for that to be happening. If, on the other hand, you're talking about a relatively confined set of people, it might be a different story. So there's nothing here that says you're not allowed to pump in a bathroom. It's talking about what the employer would need to make reasonable efforts to provide. So I, again, with the caveat that I am not a lawyer, I don't think your concern would be
very good. Too much
Benson? To worry about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me understand, you did bring up, one of the testifiers did, in terms of small businesses. So I'm thinking of, I won't use a national chain name, but I'm thinking of an auto parts place. And so they have auto parts storage and retail space and maybe one manager's office and possibly gender-separated bathroom facilities. But that's it. And, just so many of our smaller businesses, if it was General Foods, I'll just say that. That's a huge place. And certainly the accommodation would be much more possible. But I'm worried about our small businesses and now framing this as that they suddenly will have to, the office manager will have to turn over his office space to do this, because there's really no other than saying we're now going to build out a spot to do this. Have we thought of that, in terms of the ramification on small business in Minnesota?
Ms. Stratton?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The reasonableness concept is what will drive all of these situations. And, to kind of tie in the question about the enforcement mechanism, in California, they've long had a requirement that employers accommodate pregnancy. And the experience with that is that because the right's clear, that organizations like Gender Justice in California, there are similar organizations, are able to quickly and easily just negotiate and work out a practical and reasonable solution for the employee without the necessity of lawsuits and charges. So that's really what happens in these most of these cases. These things just get worked out. But providing that affirmative right is what gives the employee the ability to even ask without fear. My client was fired just for asking. So that's really what this is about. And in terms of smaller employees, employers, again, reasonableness is what will reign, and any judge would likely understand what, you know, a small business's need to do the best it can, but to not be perfect. And the babies who are being nursed aren't going to know the difference about whether their mom works for a big or a small.
Okay. Representative Benson?
I really do want to seek accommodation. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just simply I'm looking at you're saying reasonableness, and in fact I think that's what we have now, is that we have small businesses. I see the National Federation of Independent Business Representative here today. We have, in most cases, businesses that totally understand this. I have three daughters, and they decided to do that, and you know, and I can't remember a single time when there wasn't some accommodation made without a law in the human rights section of our statutes. So I'm wondering if, you know, we're, I think the message will be to small businesses that they're going to need to do something. My greater fear is there are other bills that are going to be heard today that will do a similar, have a similar effect on small businesses and creating jobs, and that this may be something that in the past they've been able to work out, and now it's going to be forced, and they'll make a determination that, no, I'm not going to build. I'm not going to do something in Minnesota. So that's my greater fear. I'd like to see it seek accommodation. My fear is that this goes kind of overboard in that, you know, I don't want to see seem like a woman hater or, you know, or I hate babies. I have four kids and I have five grandchildren. But my fear is that it's overly prescriptive. No bathrooms. I talked to a gal, actually, who said, I'd prefer to be in the bathroom. It's clean. It has the representative, you know, already brought up the situation. But that's not what it says in the law. It says no bathrooms. So I don't, maybe that was a statement, not a question.
Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, and then we'll move to the vote.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair. A couple things. You keep coming back to reasonable effort, and you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I would hope that there is some sort of bar that an employer could say this is reasonable effort or this is not, and it just seems really squishy to me as we're talking about this, which again goes to your point about this open the floodgates of litigation. So two questions, just quickly. Is there some sort of harder definition of what reasonable effort is in precedence, and then also, what kind of cost is this going to be to business to both remedy it and to litigate this? What's the potential there?
And Mr. Chair, if I may respond,
Ms.
I think Representative O'Neill has put her finger on it, and I think the reasonableness issue has been clarified today by the testifier who said reasonableness is in the eye of the beholder, being the woman, and that to me is a huge concern, because it is just simply very difficult to enforce. I don't think there's an employer, to your point, Representative Benson, who doesn't want to do the right thing for women. I have four kids myself, so I'm certainly supportive, but I will say reasonableness is a very squishy term, and that really is the concern, particularly about then bringing it under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Very, very problematic.
And did you have a second question?
I did. Thank you, Chair. Is there an estimation of cost, you know, when we're talking about both accommodation, but more importantly, litigation? Because that does seem like a really difficult to define term, reasonable effort. What does that mean? And certainly business wants to comply. I am a business owner myself. I own a construction company. I certainly want to be in compliance. My question is, where is the bar? How do we know, you know, where the bar is? So if you could answer that question about cost to business, remedy, and also litigation.
Then just briefly, Representative O'Neill, there isn't a fiscal note yet, but I suspect there will be one forthcoming. We'll be going to a fiscal committee, so that's a good question. We'll make sure we get that. But is that Representative Russo? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to wrap up, we would all like to work for employers that try to do right by their employees in all ways. I would also like to not have to lock my door at my house. And so, unfortunately, we do need to have things in statute to take care of the situations where we have someone who does not either understand what they need to do or is unwilling to do what they need to do. And so I urge you to pass this along to the next committee, and thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hickey, you indicated an interest in saying something?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Mr. Chair, I don't also...
Mr. Fahn, if you want to give him a seat there, please.
Mr. Chair, I don't also believe that you asked for any public testimony on this bill. I only went to the testifiers, and you're kind of back and forth, and went to member questions, so just for protocol.
Thank you, sir. And if you had to identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We represent 13,000 small businesses across the state, and many of them very small. I was around when this bill originally was enacted, and had a lot of discussions with Senator Anderson at the time. And the concern, the biggest concern here, is creating a new cause of action under the Human Rights Act on this, and we're strongly opposed to that. And I think Ms. Raffon covered that well. The second thing, you know, you got to realize, as some of the members have stated, that in some places, you know, I know it says an employer has to held harmless if a reasonable effort has been made. But a lot of these really small businesses at a gas and go station, at a gas station, there just isn't a place other than the bathroom. And I think it's just a reality here at the tiny little small businesses, there's just not going to be a place. And so that's concerning. And I know the language has that out, but creating a new cause of action and new lawsuits over something like this is really concerning, and it's not the direction Senator Anderson took this bill years ago, and so we're very opposed to that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hickey. And anyone else in the audience wish to testify at this point? Seeing none, Representative Urusso renews her motion that I actually renew the motion that House File 2259 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The matter is moved on to civil law. Thank you, Representative Urusso, and thank you, Mr. Testifiers, for your input. Representative Mason, if you want to come up to the table, and I'll move that House File 2274 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And Representative Mason, if you want to go ahead and begin with your presentation of the bill, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I take great pride in presenting this bill to you. This bill bans discrimination or retaliation regarding employee inquiries, disclosure, or discussion of their wages. I've always found this to be incredibly offensive. And part of the problem is that usually you sign the contractor form after you've done your job negotiations. And if you really want a job or need a job, you're really thinking twice about, do you want to go ahead and make a big issue about this? This will solve the dilemma, and in my opinion, it's long overdue. I'm going to let Lisa Stratton give you some figures.
Ms. Stratton, you want to give some further context to the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. At Gender Justice, we are currently working with other organizations at the national level and at the state level and other organizations. We're partnering with the National Women's Law Center, the National Partnership on Women and Families, the ACLU Women's Rights Project, and four other state-based women's law centers who work on law and policy, and we're all collaborating on a major initiative that is focused on closing the pay gap. And together we've identified five major contributors to the stubborn persistence of the gender wage gap despite our long-standing laws that require equal pay for equal work. One of them is the huge impediment to the enforcement of the equal pay laws caused by employees' lack of information about their wages and their realistic fears that if they discuss wages in their workplaces, they may be punished or even fired. The law currently is not clear that even policies employees are asked to sign agreeing not to discuss wages or compensation with their co-workers are illegal. The federal law that protects some employees from such retaliation, the National Labor Relations Act, is full of loopholes, and this practice of penalizing employees for discussing wages flourishes. We all know of Lilly Ledbetter, I think, at this point, the courageous woman who was only able to challenge the large disparity between her salary and her male peers' compensation. She was only able to do that after decades of unequal pay because one of her coworkers left her an anonymous note. And even then, because it had been so long, she lost her case. Now, I know we had federal legislation to try to address when she brought the cause of action, but the various advocacy groups that I was mentioning are all working on a Paycheck Fairness Act that has been introduced at the federal level. But we all know that getting Congress to act on a remedy for this is probably not likely to happen anytime soon, and there's a growing recognition in organizations working on law and policy that the action is really here with you all at the states. And this is an effort to take the key provision of that Paycheck Fairness Act and make it the law in Minnesota. Minnesota has always been at the forefront, especially on equal pay issues with our state and local government pay equity law. And through that law, we've shown that transparency in wages leads to closing the wage gap. And because most women at work in the private sector, where very high percentages, 60-some percent of women in the private sector report that they are either prohibited by policy or strongly discouraged from discussing wages at all in the workplace, there is a need for this law.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I see Ms. Raffan is going to testify. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify on this bill, just so we have some sense of? I don't see anybody else indicating. Ms. Raffan, if you want to proceed with your testimony, identify yourself once again and then go ahead.
Certainly. I'm Melissa Raffan here on behalf of the Minnesota Employment Law Council. And the question I have is, notwithstanding Ms. Stratton's comments to the contrary, what is the problem we actually are trying to resolve here? We have the National Labor Relations Act, which already has a prohibition against wage disclosure. And what is being proposed here is yet again another amendment to the Minnesota Human Rights Act to add a new provision that is very vague and has a use of very subjective terms: coerce, intimidate, threaten, or interfere, a vague use of conduct inquired about, and essentially creates a completely new category of protected activity. So under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, an individual may bring a claim for retaliation if they can show they engaged in protected activity. And protected activity is a term of art which, trust me, is fought over frequently in the courts. And to anticipate a question, retaliation claims are the greatest number of claims brought under the Human Rights Act and under Title VII. And essentially, this would expand protection under the Human Rights Act under a very subjective, amorphous concept, where if I have a conversation with a friend about what I'm making, that then constitutes protected activity sufficient to support a claim of retaliation. That would be very, very troubling and would take us in a direction that I don't think this committee intends to go into at all. In terms of the way the terms are worded, any employee essentially can, after they suffer an adverse action, can say, I inquired about my wages and therefore I have a claim under the statute. And that is very problematic. I don't believe there's been any showing that the state of Minnesota is impacted by the fact that people can't discuss their wages. And there are remedies already present under the Human Rights Act in the form of gender discrimination claims, in the form of Equal Pay Act under the state 181 chapter, under federal Equal Pay Act, and under Title VII. So this again is a piece of litigation designed to protect a problem that is already being protected under law.
Good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Stratton, do you want to respond to anything before we move on to questions from the committee?
I'm not sure it would really serve a purpose to get into a great debate here between Ms. Raffan and I. I would disagree that the discussion of wages is protected under any of those statutes.
Correct. So I'll move up to Representative Driscoll has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem that I see with this particular bill, not the conceptually on the bill, but its placement in statute under 363A.08, there are no other provisions in that statute that deal with wages or compensation or employee benefits. And so what we have to look at, members, is the subdivision that will go in there, which is lines 1.7 through 1.10, will stand on its own in this statute for independent interpretation if it does get litigated. And I just we'll take just a second to read it because it's a short provision that's being added in here. I'm going to ask one question, and with two attorneys here, I'm hoping one of them can give me the answer to this question because I can't discern that from this proposed amendment to the statute. It says, an employer shall not discharge or in any other manner discriminate or retaliate against, coerce, intimidate, threaten, interfere with an employee because the employee inquired about, disclosed, compared, or discussed the employee's wages or wages of another employee. My question is, to whom?
And I would
Ms.
say...
Ms. Rafan?
I apologize,
yeah.
Sir. I would say that you've identified one of the many myriad of problems with that language.
Ms. Stratton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem is the employer policies that prohibit any discussion anywhere. So it's being able to discuss it in a way that your employer knows you're discussing it and punishes you is the harm we're trying to...
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, and I think that we're still focusing on the wrong matter here, because it doesn't say within your employing organization. It just says discuss, disclose, and compare. So let's assume for a moment that an employee collects information from their current employer and discloses that to a competitor. This doesn't provide any protection at all for the business, and I do believe that that's the overriding factor why employers are looking for non-discussion of these kinds of things to remain there, to remain competitive with an employer in an ever-increasing competitive workforce and in an economy and a marketplace. We could be kicking the stool out from underneath these businesses who could become less competitive if this language isn't modified in such a way to protect employers from willful, because it really doesn't protect that in here as well. Again, this is under the human rights statute that we're putting this, not under any other kind of labor relations. So this stands alone in independent interpretation. I do believe that we have a time bomb ticking here, and I would again ask either one of the attorneys to respond to that, or if there is any language that could at least protect the employer from an employee disclosing that information outside of their place of employment. With public employers, we have that because we're required to do that, but private held corporations don't have to disclose their wages and pay structures to other employers. It's a problem.
And Ms. Stratton, if you want to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Employers currently are protected. They can they can have non-compete agreements, they can have confidentiality agreements, and those would still be enforceable. Potentially some of you may disagree, and if there were language that representative you wanted to offer, we can look at that. It's not the intent of the bill to provide a vehicle for people to provide competitive trade secret information to other companies.
Representative Driscoll.
I guess I'd like to hear from the other council, and we're now having lawyers in front of committees talking about these kinds of things. If that gives anyone kind of a precursor as to where this might ultimately end up and become statute.
Ms. Rafan?
Thank you. I think you've identified half the problem, which is that the statute would allow employees to disclose compensation outside of the company. The fact that they would could bring an action if they had a conversation with a friend within the company is frankly a concern of equal importance. And I think the fact that you do have two attorneys up here disagreeing is frankly exactly what I'm talking about. If we can't even agree up here, then you better believe we're going to be going to court to argue about these same things.
Representative Bugle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think this is a well-meaning bill, but I have real problems with the language also. And just following up with Representative O'Driscoll's comment, can you imagine, from a trade secret standpoint, and wages really are that way, can you imagine what it would be worth for some employee to disclose all of the wage structures of a competitor? Can you imagine what that would be worth on the open market? That being said, I would like to address 1.9 and 1.10. The way I'm reading this, you know, the employee inquired, disclosed, discussed the employer's wages of any other employee within an organization. A person could, if they wanted to, the way I'm reading this, and like my question is, would this be the case? The employee requested all the wages of everybody in a company and posted it on the bulletin board, in an email, whatever. Would he be protected? He or she be protected?
Ms. Stratton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill does not require employers to provide any particular information. So if an employee wanted to ask for every single salary in the organization or wage rate, they could do so, but no employer would be required to give it by this law.
Ms. Frappan?
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up, though, I think your question is quite good, because if an employee were to make a request like that, which probably we all agree would be unreasonable, and the employer were later to terminate for some other reason, that employer would then be sued. Under this statute, there would be a cause of action. So despite the fact that the request would be completely unreasonable, disruptive, and problematic for the workplace, the employee would then become a protected person under this statute with a cause of action.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. That's what I was driving at. I just really feel that we need to work on this language here, big time, for a number of reasons, and it's well-intentioned, but not a good bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your comments. And Representative Metza, last comment, and we'll go to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, I just want to point out that Representative Uglum, I hope no business's model of success is based on their salary structure and more what they're doing as a business and providing us a service or a product.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Mason renews her motion that House File 2274 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The matter is removed to civil law. Next up, we're going to jump, I think, to Representative Kahn's bill, since she's actually here. So I will move that House File 2371 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. I think we have an author's amendment. Is that correct, Representative Kahn?
Which I don't believe I want to make.
That you're not going to offer?
No. Okay.
So why don't you go ahead and
finally got Mr. Chairman and members. I'm very proud to carry House File 2371, because I was very active in adding disability issues to the Human Rights Act. At the time, we were very clear that we wanted pregnancy to be considered a normal condition, not a disability. And so pregnancy was not included in the definition of disability. We did have this bill before the committee last year, and we worked. I'm really pleased to carry it, because it's the perfect example of a liberal pro-life bill. And the what happened was, we didn't have very good correlation with the federal FMLA, and this bill has now been rewritten to give us good combination with the FMLA. And it's, I think very reasonable. Most of which we're looking at is an unpaid leave of absence. So it's not. So that's why I took out the amendment that I had. People were complaining about the possible abuse of removing consecutive and immediately. But one, we didn't think it's very likely. And second, I hardly get the idea that somebody would have worked for a year, taken off for a year, and then come back for a month, and then ask for an unpaid leave of absence for 12 weeks just doesn't look very sensible. So we didn't. So we decided we. And the language as written is written to combine with FMLA. Anyway, I have people here.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Kahn, for your presentation. Let's move on to the testifiers. I have a.
Yes.
Few of them here. Let's start with Susan Lane. Susan Lane, you want to come on down? And Lisa Stratton, you might as well have a chair there too if you wish.
Okay. Hi.
Welcome, Ms. Lane. Thank you for coming down this morning. And if you want to identify yourself and then provide some testimony. Is Laura Kushner here? Welcome again, and now with your glasses, you want to proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Identify yourself and then go ahead.
My name is Susan Lane, and I represent the Minnesota Better Birth Coalition. My background is in human development, but my experience over the last 18 years is that I've been working with families as a doula, a lactation counselor, and a perinatal educator. So I'm just simply here to testify to two things. One is that this bill really does bring our practices into line with best practices. We represent evidence-based care, and this is evidence-based care. There's lots and lots of information, and I do have a piece that I would be happy to share if the committee administrator is nearby.
And maybe the page could grab that and pass it out.
Right. Thank you.
And go ahead.
But briefly, I just want to testify to the health benefits and the fact that there is an enormous difference between 6 and 12 weeks. We understand that many women are not able to take 12 weeks, even if it's available to them, because of their financial situation. But where possible, all of the health care information and data that we have would support the longer period of time. Largely, this is because of the developmental stage at which babies are at. And there is a huge difference between 6 weeks and 12 weeks for both babies and mothers in terms of baby's development and mother's healing. So particularly with babies, when they are in the care of a primary caretaker, one of their parents, they are touched more, handled more, watched more through the day and through the night. And this is a very necessary thing for very young babies whose systems are not organized, which means that their heart rate is not regulated. They do not have circadian rhythms, which is a major piece. They do not have regular sleep cycles. So no matter what we've heard or what some of us grandmas like to remember, babies do not sleep through the night. Prior to about 12 to 14 weeks, that's where circadian rhythms kick in and they can begin being trained for sleep cycles. So what this means is that mothers' bodies as well are attuned in those early months to a 90-minute sleep cycle, an hour of deep sleep, and then the waking period. If mothers are not allowed to sleep during the day, they're going to be sleep deprived. That's simply the biology of it. Mothers and babies are a dyad at that period of time, and everything about the mother and the baby interacts with each other. So by 3 months, there's much more maturity, there's more safety in terms of sudden unpredicted infant death. At 3 months, babies can lift their heads 90 degrees, they can roll from their tummy to their back, things that are essentially life-saving in situations where babies are going to be cared for by caregivers who may not be able to watch them every day. So I have lots more data and lots more questions I could answer. I don't think that's necessary, but I really wanted to come and say that I am here and available to testify to the fact that there's significant health, long-term health differences, as you can see, for between 6 and 12 weeks of leave. And when mothers are able to take 12 weeks, we should be providing that for them. My daughter-in-law was not. She went back to work at 6 in a high-pressure full-time job, and she paid a health care price for it.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lane. Mm-hmm. Ms. Stratton, did you have anything you want to add right now, or are you there for questions?
I think I'm more here for questions. I just would say that the same national coalition of groups is working and supporting a Pregnant Worker Fairness Act at the federal level, and that it would similarly require these kinds of accommodations, and we can discuss all the permutations of that. I assume there would be many questions.
And Ms. Rafan, if you want to come up and, Rafan, I'm sorry, I keep butchering your name. If you would be willing to come up and provide your testimony, that'd be great. And then that'll be followed by Ms. Kushner. And if there's anyone else who wants to testify, please let us know here. So, Ms. Rafan, if you want to just identify yourself again and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Melissa Rafan here on behalf of the Minnesota Employment Law Council. And I want to say that certainly changes have been made between last year and today to the proposed bill, and we certainly appreciate the changes that were made. There still are a number of concerns that we have, and I would just like to run through those quickly. Pregnant women already have a number of protections under existing law, under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, under Title VII. This act has a very significant provision which requires that employers reasonably accommodate women and does not contain the well-established exception to that which is carved out in the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. There's no undue hardship exception, and it is very unclear as to what reasonable accommodation means in this context, given that it's not tied to existing law. On top of that, it appears that the bill allows 12 weeks time off prenatal, and then, as I understand it, it says it is not affected by other leaves, such that there could be stacking with the FMLA, and a woman could be out of the workplace for 24 weeks, which could be very problematic if the employer is required to hold the job open for that period of time. There's no requirement of medical input from a doctor for the leave, and there's no requirement of any kind of medical input for the reasonable accommodation, which again is inconsistent with existing law under the Americans with Disabilities Act, under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. In essence, there are a number of unintended consequences that flow from the bill as written, which include the following. It allows for stacking. It elevates pregnancy above other disability. It opens the floodgates of litigation. And I say that not to sound like Chicken Little in connection with each of these acts. I simply want to say that right now, there is significant employment litigation, which is a significant cost to employers, and ambiguously worded statutes will certainly increase that. And there is a very well laid out framework of reasonable accommodations under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Minnesota Human Rights Act that is not accounted for in this statute. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Friend. And President Khan, you want to say a few words?
Let me ask people to read Section 4 of the bill, which clearly covers the stacking issue.
Very good.
In other words, you can't stack.
Ms. Kushner? It would be so good as to have a seat there, and Mr. Fan will be around, I'm sure, to answer questions as well. Thank you. Go ahead and identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Kushner, and I work for the League of Minnesota Cities. We are here to testify on this bill. Let me start with the parts that we do like, because it's always nice to start with the positive. We do like, as Representative Kahn stated, we do like the fact that it eliminates the stacking issue that is currently in the law, and that has been a problem for our city, so we're happy about that part. We're also happy about within the pregnancy accommodation section that there talks about the fact that you do not have to create any additional employment in order to accommodate the pregnant employee. That is very helpful in this legislation. We like those two pieces. Unfortunately, the parts that we don't like are the fact that this will now impose, the biggest impact will be on our cities that have between 21 and 50 employees. And those cities are too big to be excluded from this law, but too large to have a lot of backup in their office and other staff. So, for example, if we have a city that has one city clerk, maybe, if they're lucky, one other office support person, maybe a couple of police officers, a couple of maintenance workers, when someone takes 12 weeks of paid leave and they have, I'm sorry, they have no backup for that, and nothing in the budget to call in temporary help. That's a problem for our cities.
I'll point out unpaid leave.
Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to point out it's unpaid leave.
Very good. Let's let the testifier complete her testimony, and we'll jump in.
And I would just address that by saying that almost every city has paid sick leave, and they allow their employees to use it for this purpose, and they would want to use it for that purpose. And we're generally fine with that. It's the amount of time that could be the problem. It will impact overtime costs and temporary staffing costs, and that's something that we're concerned about. And just let me reiterate what the previous testifier said, that in our cities, we have cities covered by Family and Medical Leave Act. Granted, that's 50 or more employees. We have the sick leave expansion bill from last year. We have the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We have the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. We have the Civil Rights Act. We have a lot of laws in Minnesota and at the federal level to protect employees from discrimination. And frankly, I think our cities do an excellent job with accommodating pregnancy, and we encourage them to do that. We want them to do that. So we're a little unclear why this is being imposed on us. So,
thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Let's give members a chance to ask some questions. There are questions to be had. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Again, we're seeing unreasonable accommodations, and we just went through this testimony with the last bill. I'm also concerned in this bill, again, that we have a really squishy definition. Businesses want to comply. Businesses and cities as well want to do what's best for their employees. They want to be in compliance with the law. This just makes it incredibly difficult, because it just seems it's, the definition just is not very broad. So can you just, and maybe we had the other testifier before, speak to the amount of litigation and the difficulty in trying to comply? She could.
Who are you directing that to, Representative O'Neill? Stan?
If Melissa could testify to that.
Okay, Ms. Stratton? Or Stratton, why don't you start, and then we'll run over to Stan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In fact, there remains a gap that has been well identified, report after report after report from national organizations and local organizations document that these cases of needing minor accommodations are the ones that are really falling through the gap. These accommodations include basic, easy things like, I want to have a water bottle with me. I work on a line. I need a periodic times when I could sit on a stool. I need to use the bathroom more frequently. And I could provide to the committee, but organizations have compiled case after case after case where women in those situations are losing those cases. They're not able to get those accommodations. This will actually make things vastly simpler. It will just be clear that an employer should accommodate those kinds of needs, and one does not need a medical certification to know that you will need to drink more water and take possibly slightly more frequent breaks.
And go ahead.
If I could just give an example from my own experience, obviously a very long time ago when I was a postdoc in a laboratory, biological laboratory, and in those days, I think now we probably have distilled water running through pipes, we had to take a very full cask of distilled water and put it up on a shelf. In order to get on the shelf, I had to climb on a chair, climb on top of the counter, pick up this thing which weighed almost as much as I did, I think, and put it up on the shelf. At some point in my pregnancy, I did not feel comfortable doing this. And so I went around and had to go ask somebody each time I needed to have this done, went and asked somebody to do it. I remembered one person sneered at me and said I ought to figure out a way to do it, which I did, but I won't go into that. But the problem is that's the kind of reasonable accommodation, which it didn't take very much. I just had to get some bigger person passing by to do that push up on the shelf.
Very good. So, Ms. Raffan, you wanted to respond to it. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I would say is this in response to that question, that first I would like to say that we appreciate that the intent is to not allow stacking. That is not clear from the current wording of the statute. I will also say that as it relates to the accommodation piece, accommodation is already covered under the Human Rights Act, under the Disability Provision, under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, and under Title VII. To create a brand new accommodation piece is not required under existing law. And to say that someone needs to have an additional drink of water does not need to be put in legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. You know, as I'm looking at this bill, Representative Kahn, now the first time you brought it, I recall that it was defined within a certain number of employees, and I don't see that language. Am I missing that? Is this all employers of all employee sizes? And I know the city spoke to the 21 to 50. Is it still 21 to 50, or is it under 21 employees? I'm a bit confused.
Representative Kahn?
I think it's in the section of staff. I think your staff guys might know that. I think it's in the section of statute that covers it. So.
Ms. Newman, is it something you can kind of out of nowhere?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, this is the definition of employer under the current parenting leave is in section 181.940, and that's an entity that employs 21 or more employees at least one site. So this does not change that definition.
Okay. Thank you. That was
very good. And Representative Lane, that could be the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment that what we're talking about here is pregnancy, the birth of our future. These are our children, our future. These are our children we're talking about in our society. And all we're talking about here as far as the leave is six measly weeks, to accommodate the life and well-being of a child and therefore the mother of that child in working with that child. This is a simple thing. This is about our future. I can understand the difficulty in this and the accommodation of a mother to have a good birth and to care for that child prenatally and then for 6 weeks longer than we already do now, because we know that the first 3 months are crucial.
Very good. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to address that. I don't think we're opposed to it. I think that we're just trying to make good policy. And I think as an employer myself, yeah, I own a construction company, as I said earlier. We want to comply. Employers want to comply. But when it's unclear in the law what we're complying to, it makes it very difficult. And there are challenges in this particular legislation. We're not opposed to the concept. We're opposed to the policy that makes it unclear how to comply as an employer. Employers want to comply. I think we have incredible employers across the state of Minnesota. Are there a few bad apples? Of course. In every single situation, there's always the 2%, right? There's always the 2%. It doesn't matter. You know, I used to be on the board of the Buffalo Food Shelf. We knew that we had 2% of people that would lie to us on the application and take more food than they were supposed to. And we didn't punish the 98% because of the 2%. We understand that there's always a 2%. And our contention is not with the fact that this is a good concept or not a good concept. It is a good concept. I've given birth to 3 children. I've worked through 3 pregnancies and went back to work right after. And I know the difference between a 6-week-old and a 12-week-old. And I can tell you, after my first child, I didn't sleep for the first 3 months. And after a month and a half, at that 6-week point, I had to take my competency exams for my master's degree program. And I remember thinking, I can't even make a clear statement. How am I going to pass these exams? Which I did, so I must have known my material. But we are not saying that we aren't approving of this. We are policymakers. We want to make the best policy, and there have been legitimate issues raised regarding the Civil Rights Act, the Human Rights Act. There's some things that are unclear. Businesses want to comply. We want to make good policy here.
Very good.
And that is the contention.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Last comments, Representative Kahn, and then we'll move to the vote.
I just wanted to say, do I get to compare that to taking your PhD exam in biophysics? But anyway, I just think that this is, when you read through it, this is so completely reasonable. It fits in with existing laws. We had a very good hearing last year, which pointed out the problems that we had. We fixed those problems, and I urge you to pass the bill.
Thank you very much. The chair renews this motion that House File 2371 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The matter is re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Members, we're going to recess till 4 p.m., and we're going to meet back in the same room, so pack your folders accordingly. We're going to take up Representative Lesch's bill, 2461, at that time. So thank you, everyone, for your indulgence and input this morning. With that, we're in recess. Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to reconvene the Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industries Committee from this morning, and we have one bill before us. The chair moves that House File 2461 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. We'll take Representative Lesher's presentation of the bill, hear from some testifiers, open up for committee questions, and go from there. So with that, Representative Lesch, welcome to the committee, and please give us your overview of the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. What's the motion to which this bill is referred, Mr. Chair? It's going to me. It's going to civil law.
Going to civil law.
I'd ask that it be sent to my committee then.
And do you have a couple amendments?
Yes, there are two amendments.
Yes, two amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The A1.
I would ask that the A1 and the A2 be moved.
I'll move the A1 amendment. Anything you want to say about it? Or is it pretty obvious?
It's very technical.
Looks pretty straightforward.
It's very technical.
We're just, so it says Labor and Industry after Commissioner.
Got it.
The A1 amendment, so it's just technical. So
put it in the shape you want. Members, any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. And then the A2 amendment, Representative Lesch, same thing?
That's right. It's technical, Mr. Chair.
Again, to put the bill in the shape that the author prefers, I'll move that amendment. Members, any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Representative Lesch, we have the bill as you want it in front of us. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, this bill for earned sick leave for Minnesota employees will be a big step in making Minnesota the kind of state that we want to live in. This has been a long slog, actually. It was originally 2008 that I was working with Senator Anderson to try to bring some kind of earned sick leave to Minnesota. And a lot of compromises were reached over the course of that time, and there were some changes in the state and national economy since then as well. What this bill will do is help everyday moms and dads when they are faced to make an impossible choice for a loved one, whether they take care of that loved one or whether they lose a paycheck. We don't want that to be the kind of thing they have to face, and at least give them some breathing room on that, which is just some room for earned sick leave. So when they're dealing with a sick child, a chronically ill parent or an elder, or just needing some time to heal, we believe that the priority should be that we put our families first. And the stats show this is important for Minnesota. 41% of Minnesota employees don't have earned sick leave. And think about this the next time you're going through the line at Subway, that the folks on the other side of the sneeze guard don't have earned sick leave, ironically, even if you do. Those are the folks who you really want to have it, because if they don't have earned sick leave, those are the folks that are 50% more likely to go to work when they're sick. These are folks that, and 72% of the people that don't have it are people making less than $20,000 a year. 52% of working parents don't have a single earned sick day to take care of a child, and nearly a quarter of workers in Minnesota have been threatened with job loss or have actually lost a job because they took time off to take for an illness or to care for a loved one. This impact spreads rapidly, and among jurisdictions that have enacted this, Mr. Chair, members, businesses who have opposed it previously come around to it because of the cost of what in the industry is called presenteeism. This costs the U.S. economy $160 billion annually. So for that one person who didn't take off work and then comes to work and affects everyone else, the estimated costs of that are $160 billion annually. Businesses recognize this. They see this as an issue that needs to be addressed. And earned sick leave is a way to alleviate that burden, not just on our working families in Minnesota, but also on the businesses that have to deal with the fallout from people who go to work sick. Working adults without earned sick days are nearly twice as likely to have family members skip or delay medical care, and parents without earned sick time are twice as likely to send a child to school when they're sick. Also, parents without earned sick days are much more likely to take their child or family member to the emergency room. As everyone knows, that costs a lot more. So to fix this impossible choice, Ms. Chair and members, this bill is the answer to help fix the impossible choice, where you don't have to choose between your family and losing a paycheck. So this bill creates a family-friendly policy that folks across Minnesota support. 96% of single moms who are surveyed in late 2013 said this would help them. 75% of the public favors a law providing minimum number of earned sick leave days for all workers. 86% favor a specific proposal that requires 7 earned sick days annually for full-time employees, including 69% strongly favoring, and 6 in 10 strong Republicans favor unearned sick leave law. So we can make life better for our families in doing this, Mr. Chair and members, and I would ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Blush, for your presentation, and we have a testifier. Go ahead and
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm representing AARP and Take Action Minnesota today. And I was asked to just go through a quick overview of what is in the bill by section, and then I think we're going to move to our testifiers. So in Section 1, Subdivision 1 contains the key definitions for the terms that are used in this bill. There's a definition of covered employee, and so a covered employee must work for an employer for 30 days. This bill applies to large and small employers, and it includes a definition of extended family member. So a person, a worker could use earned sick to care for an extended family member, and extended family member is defined as an individual related by blood or affinity whose close association with the covered employee is the equivalent of a family relationship. It also includes definitions related to domestic violence, thus the reason for the term safe in the bill, in that this allows a worker to earn leave that can be used for either sickness or in the event they have suffered from sexual violence or a member of their family has suffered from sexual violence. So there's definitions of sexual assault, stalking in the bill. Subdivision 2 deals with the accrual of sick and safe time, and in this subdivision we distinguish between employers with 21 or more employees. Leave can be accrued up to a maximum of 72 hours per calendar year by a worker. And for employers with fewer than 21 employees, leave may be accrued up to a maximum of 40 hours per calendar year. Sick and safe time begins to accrue at the commencement of employment for covered employees, but may not be used until after the 90th day of employment. It allows employers to adopt more generous policies than required by this law. And moving to Subdivision 3 delineates the uses of sick and safe time. And Subdivision 4 prohibits retaliation against an employee. Subdivision 5 sets forth the requirements for employer notices and allows for the requirements to be satisfied by notice and posting. Subdivision 6 authorizes the Commissioner of Labor to adopt rules for implementing sick and safe time law. Subdivision 7 provides remedies, which include both a private right of action and the ability of a worker to be able to make a complaint to the AG, who could then bring an action. Subdivision 8 deals with confidentiality and non-disclosure, and information that is possessed by the employer is considered confidential. Subdivision 9 says that nothing in this law discourages or prohibits an employer from adopting more generous policies. And Subdivision 10 deals with what occurs when an employee leaves employment. It specifies that financial reimbursement is not required when an employee separates from employment. Section 2 deals with the severability of the statute, and Section 3 repeals current law.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Members, we'll continue to take testimony and then open up for members' questions thereafter. So I'm going to just kind of go down the list here. I thought I saw Mary Jo George. Mary Ann Beers, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Come on down then.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Could we possibly have an updated agenda or something with the testifiers listed? I don't have one in my packet.
They're all cleaned out, all of our agenda.
Okay. I could read it to you. Would that be helpful? Okay. We'll get a copy made.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Okay, you may go ahead with your identify yourself for the record. Mary Jo, were you going to testify to Ms. George?
Very briefly.
Okay, if the two of you would then identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, Mary Jo George with AARP. Sorry about that delay. I am here, and our member, Mary Ann Beers, is here to testify, and so she will do the primary testimony. But again, just for the record, we want you to know AARP strongly supports this legislation. As I indicated this morning, you know, as the population ages, more and more workers are having to provide elder care responsibility, and this is coming at a significant economic cost to caregivers if they have to leave the workforce because they can't juggle their work demands with their caregiving. So, Mary Ann, go ahead.
Ms. Beers, please identify yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman.
And pull the microphone to yourself.
Members of the committee and esteemed guests, my name is Mary Ann Beers. I am 58 years old, currently living in Lake Elmo, Minnesota. Though my mother is now in assisted living, I am still involved in caregiving for her, overseeing financial and personal needs, including her medications. Prior to that, I was a caregiver for my father, who died in 2009, and my former partner, Kent, who had a stroke in 2008. I am here to testify in support of HF 2461, a bill allowing employees to use earned sick time caring for aging parents and other relatives. I worked at a large financial company for 16 years, and when my job was outsourced in 2006, my father took a turn for the worse, and I began caregiving full time. My partner was also caring for his parents, and we devoted our weekends to our parents. In 2008, I had gotten a new job at a large nonprofit in Minneapolis. My father was not doing very well, I had paid sick time at this job for myself, which I was grateful for. However, I was not allowed to use this when I needed to leave to accompany my father to the emergency room, which happened on at least three occasions. I received verbal and written warnings for utilizing my earned sick time on short notice and was disciplined for being absent. Though I spoke to my boss before leaving, and she told me it was all right for me to leave. When I returned the next day, I was written up for this. May I continue?
Please.
I also asked then if I could come in early or stay late to make up time or just simply take time off with no pay, which was denied. Although my boss and at times my coworker were allowed to leave and do come in early or stay late, my boss's daughter had a debilitating condition and frequent seizures, so of course she needed to leave at times, and as far as I know, she was never written up or reprimanded for this. Though I was gone at times, 99% of the time while I was at this job, I was present. However, the time I was gone for caregiving was unacceptable to my boss. My former partner, Kent, was in a more difficult position than I was. He was in an inventory job. He had no HR person to go to, which I ended up going to before I resigned my job in 2009 after my father died of a heart attack. And he could not use sick time, nor could he leave his job. And he was caring for his father and was under extreme stress. And in September of 2008, he had a debilitating stroke, which he never recovered from. I know that in taking time off, Kent's life probably would have taken a different turn. I don't know why taking sick days, if we have them and we use them, we are then penalized for this, for elder care. I feel the passage of this bill, HF 2461, would have protected not only myself but Kent. At a time right now when over 150 million people in this nation are turning 50 and older, we don't do a very good job at taking care of each other at end of life. In June of 2013, my former partner, Kent, died, and he was murdered. He would have been 59 years old. When I say his life unraveled because he was given no kindness at his job, I mean it. I tell you this story because I know this bill implemented will change a perception in our culture that it is not valuable or important to care for the people we love, particularly if they are elderly. And caregivers deserve to have sick time, FMLA, protection against discrimination, because discrimination is a cancer. I tell you this because caregivers are the backbone of our long-term care system, and our parents' challenges are the indicators of this larger story. So it is right here and now. And when this bill is passed and implemented, it will protect and give caregivers the acknowledgement they deserve, as well as those they care for. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Beers. Appreciate it. Mr. Conroy, Ms. Hunt. Ms. Hunt, are you here? Seeing that, okay, Mr. Conroy, if you want to identify yourself for the record and briefly give your testimony.
Chairman Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Chris Conroy. I'm here today representing Take Action Minnesota and would like to speak in favor of House File 2461. Every day, a mom or dad in Minnesota is forced to make a difficult choice about caring for a loved one or going to work. And we believe that House File 2461 makes this choice a little bit easier for Minnesotans by guaranteeing employees 1 hour of earned safe and sick time for every 30 hours they work. For many of us, earned sick time is something we take for granted, but for others, it is a real crisis. In December, a staff member of ours met a woman named Kesana. Kesana was 37 years old. She had two children, ages 8 and 13. Last year, she worked at a major national retailer in St. Paul. In late November, her 8-year-old daughter got the flu, and she got the flu as well. And because of that, she missed 3 days of work in one pay period. And when she called in after those absences, her employer informed her that if she had 5 absences in that pay period, she would be fired, but that she had the option of quitting and reapplying for her job later if she didn't miss all 5 days. So she decided to quit her job. Stories like Kesana's, unfortunately, are all too common for too many workers in our state. The Institute for Women's Policy Research estimates that over 924,000 private sector workers in Minnesota lack earned sick and safe time. That is a full 44% of private sector workers in our state. The problem is most acute amongst the lowest paid workers, like Kesana. 79%, that's 4 out of 5 workers making less than $20,000 a year, do not have earned sick time. And this basic reality threatens their health, threatens their job security, and it threatens their family stability. So we urge you to keep these families and folks like Kesana in mind when you consider your vote on this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Conroy. Ms. Parrish, Ms. Flanagan, are you present in the audience? Parrish or Flanagan? Oh, Ms. Flanagan, nice to see you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Erin Parrish. I'm here representing the Minnesota Women's Consortium. We are a statewide coalition of 132 nonprofit organizations and 4,200 individuals committed to advancing equity and justice for all women in Minnesota. I'm here to testify in support of earned sick and safe time and respectfully urge your vote in support of this bill. Minnesota is a national leader in women's workforce participation. Workforce participation of mothers with children under 6 has increased the most and is now at 79%. However, women face the double disadvantage of being breadwinners and often the main caregivers of children and older family members. They are disproportionately impacted by a lack of paid sick days since they compromise 2/3 of those working for low wages that do not always offer sick leave or paid time off. Scores of Minnesotans are forced to make impossible decisions every day, whether to care for loved ones who are ill or to deal with a loss of income and potential backlash at work. 2/3 of family caregivers are women, yet 54% of working mothers lack access to even a few paid sick days they can use to care for their children or parents. This issue is particularly pertinent for women of color. In many families, women of color are the primary source of financial support and the primary caregivers. More than 3 million African American families with children have female head of household, most often a mother, grandmother, or other relative who is her family's only source of support. And the same is true for more than 2 million Latino families in the country. At all levels of our policy work, the Minnesota Women's Consortium supports policies that allow women the opportunity to reach their full potential. A lack of earned sick and safe time does not allow all women and families to choose to stay healthy and continue to enjoy a level of economic security that pays their rent and food and living expenses. No woman, no person, or no family in Minnesota should have to choose between health for themselves or a family member or a missed paycheck.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Parrish, for your testimony. Ms. Flanagan, welcome. Just identify yourself for the record before you begin, and then go ahead and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Peggy Flanagan. I'm the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Mr. Chair, thank you for this, and committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. The Children's Defense Fund is a nonprofit child advocacy organization that champions programs and policies to improve child well-being. Our mission is to ensure that every child has a healthy start, a head start, a fair start, a safe start, and a moral start in life. We provide strong, effective, independent voice for all children who cannot vote, lobby, or speak for themselves, and that's why I'm here. I'm here to speak in support of this bill of providing sick and safe time for all working Minnesotans from the child and family perspective. I also might add that I'm here as a mom, I'm here as a long-term caregiver for my mother, and I'm here as a survivor and child witness of domestic violence. A lack of access and earned sick and safe time comes at a cost to parent and child health, and even at a cost for the parent who may lose his or her job, which in turn decreases a family's economic stability. Currently, half of all working parents do not have access to this needed benefit. Low-wage workers are disproportionately represented among individuals who do not have access to earned sick and safe time. In fact, 81% of individuals making 8, 10, or less an hour lack access, and the majority of those individuals are women. On the other hand, you know, providing earned sick and safe time, as this bill would allow parents to take time to care for their own and for their child's health and safety needs without risk of job loss or reduced income. Earned sick and safe time is good for parental and child health and well-being, and even ensures that employers have a healthier, more productive workforce and less turnover. So on behalf of all children who deserve to grow up in healthy families, in safe families, and in stable families, we ask you to support this bill, and I welcome any questions that you might have.
Very good. If you just want to stick around for questions, that'd be fine.
Great.
Thank you, Ms. Flanagan, for
Thank
your testimony.
You.
Mr. Carlson? And Mr. Kushner,
yes.
Ms. Kushner, up next.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 9 of the larger and growing counties in greater Minnesota and 4 here in the metropolitan area. I want to thank Representative Lesh for listening to some of our concerns, and also thank the committee for giving me that same consideration. First, I think it's necessary to clarify what the state of the current law is, because some of the situations that have been testified to by the proponents are already covered by a law change that was made last year for those employers who already provide sick leave. Last year, requirements for sick leave was expanded to not only for the individual himself and his or her child, minor child, but also to an adult child, a parent, a grandparent, a sibling, or a spouse. So many of the situations that you just heard testified to would be covered under current law for those employees who currently provide sick leave. So our concern is not with the provisions of the bill that suggests that's expanding to it. Again, that's already current law. Our concerns are with expansions beyond that, the accrual rates, and as I will go through. Has been mentioned on previous testimony, this bill goes beyond the current class of individuals for whose illnesses or injuries you can take sick leave to any individual related by blood or affinity whose close association with the covered employee is the equivalent of a family relationship. I frankly don't know who that is, but it will be troublesome for human resources departments to administer. I do want to also mention that one of the provisions of the law change that was included last year was a requirement of a report from the Department of Management and Budget that's due in August of the year that will identify the effects in terms of cost and additional leave that was given as a result of last year's expansion. I highly suggest that you should wait until you have that information before you go towards further expansion. Another provision of the bill that does not affect the employers that I have is that it makes the provision of sick leave mandatory. Again, for our full-time permanent employees, that's simply not an issue. But it does expand it to certain employees on a seasonal or temporary basis who are currently not covered by sick leave. Most of our employers do not provide sick leave or for individuals who are employed for less than 6 months because of the seasonal or temporary nature of this employment. This bill extends sick leave to those, and that will be an additional cost that will cause us, frankly, to raise property taxes, another concern of this legislature. A particularly large issue in this bill is it also extends sick leave to those employees who are simply working with us as recipients of public assistance, such as the state's MFIP program, who have to engage in work activities as a condition of receiving their employment. These individuals are basically getting job skills while they work with us. And if this provision goes into effect, it's going to cause us to reduce the number of positions that we can offer because we will now have to pay sick leave. We will also have to pay FICA taxes on that sick leave. We will also possibly have to pay PERA on that sick leave. So all additional costs that are not contemplated and I think are contrary to the intents of the proponents to assist particularly women who are challenged in their current economic circumstances. A very large issue for all the for many of the current employers is it's not clear under this bill how what is called paid time off or flex leave, where effectively sick leave and vacation leave are combined. When an employee wants to take leave, it doesn't really matter from the employer's perspective. They get to take it with the whatever notice requirements are required. It's not clear under this bill whether or not they qualify or whether this sick leave would be on top of that. Obviously, that situation where it would be on top of is something that we do not want to occur. As I said, the accrual provisions in the bill is also troublesome for us in some instances. For St. Louis County, in particular, their first-year employees are limited to 52 hours of sick leave accrual. This bill would provide 69 hours, so that's additional expense for it. It also provides no limitation whatsoever on the amount of sick leave that can be carried over. Many employers, such as Dakota County, for example, have a 1,000-hour limit on the amount of sick leave that can be carried. This bill, once an employee reaches 14 years of service, will be beyond that, and the county would be powerless to do that. That's particularly troublesome for public employers where under the provisions of some collective bargaining agreements, they're required to pay cash for some portion of the unutilized sick leave. Despite the language to the contrary in this bill that there's no liquidation of that sick leave, we have to integrate it with the provisions of our collective bargaining agreement. So we will be paying out more under this legislation. Final couple of provisions that I want to bring to the committee's attention. Under the current law that extended sick leave to those instances where an employee wants to take it for other than themselves or their minor child, there's a provision that no more than 160 hours have to be granted for that purposes. This bill takes that off. So with that, Mr. Chairman, members, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And I know there are a few questions that will be forthcoming, but if you would just wait here, and once we complete testimony, we'll get to that. And go ahead, Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just procedurally, as we're switching testifiers here, is there going to be a fiscal note on this based on what Mr. Carlson testified to?
You might probably want to direct that to Representative Lesh. Do you know what the status is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll. Did you mean a fiscal note or a local impact note?
Well, I'll just broadly say financial impact, because the state may have that as well as local impact and any of our public jurisdictions that would be governed by this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, there have been local impact notes requested in the past. So it was not my intent to request one, but let me talk to you offline. We'll see the process and procedure for that. But
let me just interrupt just briefly, and to Representative Driscoll's question, a fiscal note I have been advised has been requested.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Ms. Kushner, welcome, and if you want to identify yourself, please.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Laura Kushner. I work for the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm here today representing them on this issue. First, let me just say, in the interest of time, Mr. Carlson put forward a lot of the same concerns that we at the League of Minnesota Cities have. So I will just speak briefly to one concern and expand on it a little bit. Many of our cities, as you probably know, hire many seasonal and temporary employees. So if the city has a swimming pool or a beach, they may hire college kids to come work during the summer at that beach, and then they go back to college in the fall. It is not typical for our cities to give sick leave benefits or vacation benefits to these jobs. They're never intended to be full-time career jobs. They're just seasonal jobs. And if we start providing sick leave for those people in those positions, it will increase costs for cities, and that will translate to higher park and recreation fees for the public. So that isn't something that we would be happy to see. The having sick leave restored at rehire is another issue for our cities for these same kinds of employees. If you have the college kids coming back every year, which cities do use them that way, then they're just going to, the sick leave balance is going to grow and grow. I'm appreciative of the fact that it doesn't result in a payment at termination. We do appreciate that being in the bill, but it will still increase costs for cities because the lifeguards have to be replaced. They'll have to hire somebody else in. It might be overtime. It just pretty much makes the job for cities more difficult. So that would be some of our major concerns with this bill, as well as the ones expressed by Mr. Carlson.
Good. Well, thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Kushner.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Ms. Rafan. Did I get that right? Welcome again. And if you'd identify yourself, please, and go ahead.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Melissa Rafan, here on behalf of Minnesota Employment Law Council. And as Ms. Kushner said, I think Mr. Carlson made a number of really excellent points. I just have a couple of additional ones that I'm thrilled to say I haven't heard discussed already. The first is that this sick leave law runs roughshod over collective bargaining acts. There's a provision in it saying it does not diminish the right of employers to comply with more generous CBA, but it doesn't say what happens when the CBA is less generous. The second, Mr. Carlson raised this point, which is quite good, and that is many employers offer paid time off policies that are more generous than that is being put forth in the statute, but the statute does not expressly reference those. It is my expectation that a paid time off policy would trump the sick leave law and would not require the accrual, because I will tell you the accrual of 1 hour for every 30 hours worked is an administrative nightmare for an employer to administer. And for many of our members who are national employers, having to comply with different states' accrual policies is really an administrative burden. So my assumption would be that that would not be required. No one yet has touched on the remedy section, which I need to bring to your attention as being quite draconian. In an unprecedented move, and I know I've used that more than once today, but I'm telling you, there's basis for each of them. There is a 5-year statute of limitations for this statute, which is not seen in nearly any other employment law statute, and frankly is without precedent. Courts recognize that in the employment context, the statute of limitation needs to be very short. The Minnesota Human Rights Act statute is 365 days. Title VII statute is 300 days, so this idea that someone can sit on their rights for 5 years and bring a claim is unprecedented and is a very, very negative step. In addition, the statute, for some reason, unlike the others in 181, encourages people to bring class actions. Whether or not you got your earned sick time would be an individual action, Mr. Chair. It would not be a class action. And there is no basis for that kind of remedy in a statute like this. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And I assume if the bill does pass and goes to civil law, Representative Lesh, you'll deal with some of these remedy issues as well. But
absolutely.
We'll see.
Absolutely. Hyperbole aside, Mr. Chair.
All right. Mr. Hickey? Thank you, Ms. Rafan, for your fan for your testimony. And if there's anyone else who wishes to testify, please have a kind of go over there by the wall, and we'll make sure you get a chance to add your testimony. Welcome. Identify yourself, please, and let's go from there.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. Good to see you again today. I just want to make a few brief comments. Want to echo all the other comments by the other groups. Very concerned about new mandates on employers, and what we have here is, you know, for the first time, a sick leave mandate on even the smallest employers. National Federation of Independent Business represents 13,000 employers across the state, as I mentioned this morning, and some very small ones. And so we're very concerned about mandates on companies as small as 2 and 3 people. Now, granted, the leave that Representative Lesh is mandating here is modest, but still, it's capped out and it's modest, but still just this precedent we're setting of getting down to companies with 2 and 3 people is very concerning to us and something we're very opposed to. We're also extremely concerned about some of the points raised earlier about even extending to temporary and seasonal people. And this is going to be administratively difficult for very small businesses to do. They don't have an HR office. Typically, an owner is doing this himself at night or on the weekend. But trying to administer all this, if you had a lot of temporary and seasonal employees, that's certainly going to increase the burden of it. We're also very concerned about the expansion to extended family members and a whole lot of other folks in Subdivision 3. And as Mr. Carlson mentioned, there's no cap on it. And so that's an expansion that goes above and beyond last year's bill. I think just a practical point on this expanded use of sick leave that everybody has to be mindful of. Now, granted, Representative Lesh is not mandating a lot here, but if somebody uses up all their sick leave caring for somebody else and they find themselves in a hospital for a week or two, and you know, they did receive sick leave from the employer or through this bill or both, they could exhaust it and find themselves on the mend trying to recover from an unexpected illness and getting no pay for it. And so I think that's just a practical point as we expand this. And finally, the legal consequences of a very long statute of limitations are very concerning. I don't think they have any place in this bill. And if there is going to be a statute of limitations on a cause of action in this bill, it ought to be very brief. It ought to be 1 year or even less. Why should anybody sit on a claim for that long, let it get that stale, then bring it forward, and then all the legal morass that causes by a very stale old claim? So anyways, I just wanted to share those thoughts with you.
Thank you very much for that. Appreciate it. Mr. Gerber, and if anyone's with him, you're welcome to join him. Apparently not. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record, sir. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on labor issues. I think, like the testifiers before, I think Mr. Carlson and Ms. Rafan did a great job in really highlighting some of our major concerns. I want to highlight one. One of the concerns that I have is this bill was compared to states that have done this. There's very few states that have done this. The ones that have, Connecticut comes to mind, are very prescriptive. There's a lot of exceptions. It's very narrow. It looks nothing. Their statute looks nothing like this bill, and I think it's difficult to even compare them. So I think to start on, I'm happy to provide the chair a copy of Connecticut statute, and they actually have a great equivalent to the Department of Labor and Industry has a great PowerPoint that explains how it should be administered, and I think it's you know, this bill has a lot of issues. So does that so with that bill. It's not that I'm supporting that bill, but I think it's important to look at where it's been done before. One of the biggest concerns that I have is just some of the provisions in here that might seem minor. I mean, but it's a dramatic expansion of what we've seen before. I think one of the things that's upsetting from the business community standpoint is we worked with some of the advocates last year to what we thought come to a good agreement on existing sick leave, which was that you could use your existing leave to care for other relatives, as Mr. Carlson pointed out. Some of the examples that were brought forward would be covered under current law. And we thought that was a great step forward for the business community and some of the advocates. And now, this year, this is a drastic expansion, I mean, almost a radical expansion compared to what was done last year. And I think it's important to note that. I think, again, the threat of lawsuits, the five-year statute of limitations is concerning to the business community. I had and I'll wrap up with, I got an email from a member today that said, you know, we have the $9.50 minimum wage likely to go forward. We have all these other policies, and now the legislature wants to step in and be my human rights department, our human resources department. And that was really concerning. A small business owner, they own a doggy daycare and a small, not even actually one of the chamber members, but just came across us. So I think it's important to think about that. I mean, we're now telling businesses how their human resources operations should run, and that's a great concern, especially to someone that is happy that happily provides these jobs, but you know, can't afford to offer these generous incentives.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber, for your testimony, and you could stick around. Looks like two more testifiers, and then. Okay. Go ahead, sir. Identify yourself off the record.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bo Bernstein.
Try not to repeat all that has been said.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. You obviously heard from Mr. Carlson from our partner county organization. I will not repeat his points, but because Representative O'Driscoll did raise the issue of a local impact note, we did have some conversations today to try to start that process to give you a better picture of what the impact on local governments will be. And as representing AMC, I would ask the legislature to, just as you would not pass a bill without understanding first the state financial implications, wait until the completion of the local impact notes so you have an understanding of what this will mean to local governments as well. Thank
Very
you.
Very good. Give me your name one more time.
Yeah, Bo Bernson, Association of Minnesota Counties, and I did sign it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bernson. And next up, ma'am, have a seat and identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony. And then we have one more woman want to testify. Okay. Very good. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the school districts of the state of Minnesota. I'm here, and I won't repeat what's already been said. We have concerns. Our school districts have collective bargaining contracts that cover all employees and provide sick time. We're concerned about the term safe time and how that figures in, and we encourage more clarity as to what you're looking for. Also, terms like extended family. So I just wanted to put on the table that there are some good actors at the table that this could maybe impact negatively going forward, and so any kind of clarity the legislature could add to these terms to make it very clear what they're looking for would be a great benefit.
Thank you, Ms. Kellner, for your testimony. Appreciate it. And then lastly, if you want to come up and identify yourself, please, and then provide testimony, and we'll move to member questions and concerns.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Hello, you're welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
My name is Ann Lott, and I represent Take Action Minnesota. I'm a single mom, and I'm in part with the sick day laws. My experience with this is I raised seven children, and I had to work a third shift job just to make ends meet. I had a good job. I thought it was great. I was making $14.80 an hour. It came to a abrupt end. The company I worked for had a point system, and I pointed out. Kids got sick. It was time off, doctor's appointments. One got sick, the next one got sick. So I pointed out, and I just want to say that with this law, I think it would help people like myself to get good-paying jobs and to keep good-paying jobs. I thought that was $14.80 was a great job, and it made ends meet. I paid my bills, but I did get fired, and I have then since went back to school, and I have another job, but it's hard for single mothers. So I'm here asking that you really consider this law. And thank you.
Thank you for taking time out of your day to testify. Appreciate it. We're going to open it up to questions, and we have Representative Hoppe on the list. And start right there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesher. I'm wondering how many states around us have laws like this in place?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe, around us, we would be pioneers in affecting this important legislation for working families. Connecticut has a law that achieves a similar result, but there are other municipalities, cities throughout the nation have enacted it the same. And I would use this opportunity to point out that I think I stated in my testimony that businesses, similar to the ones who business organizations who have testified against it here, and incidentally I would point out they also opposed last year's pioneering change for use of sick leave with some of the same language at the beginning, and now we have it, that the businesses in those jurisdictions that have passed the Representative Hoppe now generally think it's an all right idea.
One final comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You use the word pioneers. I use the word island. Thank you, Representative Lush. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Any further questions right now? Representative O'Neill? Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Representative Lesh, could you just maybe enlighten me and explain why you're thinking going down the road of sick leave as opposed to PTO, which would have been much more flexible, maybe easier to administrate? You know, where the testifiers were speaking, they used words like run over collective bargaining, that there's it's an administrative nightmare. There were a lot of very strong language used, not just from the business sector, but also from our cities and our local governments, and I'm very concerned. Can you just first speak to the first question about PTO?
Sure.
Representative Lesh?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, proponents believe that this would be less onerous than a PTO system insofar as it provides more restrictive situations than you would be able to use for paid time off, which is would be more permissive.
Representative O'Neill, follow up.
Oh yeah, please. Thank you, Chair. I guess I'm not following, because PTO means if you need to take time off, you don't have to tell the employer what it's for. As long as they can let you have time off, you have time off. So to me, this would be more restrictive, not less restrictive. I guess I'm not following your logic. Can you try explaining it one more time?
Sure.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. And it would be more restrictive for the employee, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, more restrictive for the employee. Because it would fall under the categories of what you would be able to use it for, as opposed to paid time off, where, I mean, it depends on what kind of paid time off you're talking about, but the bill lays out pretty, that delineates the boundaries for which you could use this.
Representative.
Thank you, if I may.
You have a further question?
Yes, please, if I may.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. And then back to, you know, Mr. Carlson laid out very clearly pages and pages and pages of concerns, not only for for local governments, but small businesses as well. And even, I guess I didn't realize, you went all the way down to one employee. Do we do anything like that right now, where we legislate something like this all the way down to one employee? We had four other bills earlier today, and they had it started at 21 employees and up. I have a very small company, and that's very onerous for me personally, but can you explain your thought process of including every single company with even one employee?
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Representative O'Neill. The thought process is that a single mom with two kids, like the last testifier, doesn't necessarily have control over how many coworkers she has and when she gets sick. So that's the intent, is to make sure that all working families in Minnesota are helped out.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I appreciate your latitude. With concern to temporary and seasonal employees, which, can you explain your thought process maybe, or why are we going to that level where we're covering seasonal and temporary employees, especially if I think of, you know, like the instance was given by the local government about a lifeguard. So we're going to be covering temporary and seasonal employees and teenagers, and we're not just talking about single moms here. We're talking about a much. I mean, we're talking about every employee.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair,
Representative
Black, Representative O'Neill. You know, we have this same discussion when we talk about the pension issue, who should be covered by pensions, and there's a philosophy in that pensions. Take care of those folks so we don't have to spend state services on them because they're accruing those. Some people say, well, hang on a second. If you're a lifeguard in the summer, I heard the mention lifeguard, you lifeguard for a couple months where you're home from college, that it's not intended to cover that. Yet at the same time, is it an interest that we make sure people are saving for their retirement so we don't have to spend state services for them afterwards? This is similar. That said, it is a bit of a red herring, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, in that you can't use it if you're employed less than 90 days. That's specifically in the bill. So if you're lifeguard in June, July, and August, you can't use it during that time. And again, I think it's kind of a red herring because, you know, are you lifeguarding full time? Usually, you know, you pick up a few hours here, a few hours there. Being able to earn 1 hour for every 30 hours worked is pretty minimal. I would seriously doubt any lifeguard out of pool would make it up to a single shift where they could use those hours. So, like I mentioned before, there's a little bit of hyperbole involved in some of the language that's been used, draconian, worst thing ever. When you really look at the details of the bill, I think as Mr. Hickey stated, it's pretty minimal. When we think that people after this has passed will find this is pretty minimal as well.
Very good.
And last question.
Representative O'Neill, my last question.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Chair. So let's go to something that's not hyperbole, which is the 5-year statute of limitations, where, you know, the Human Rights Act has 365 days and another section of law has 300 days. So why are you going 5 times that in this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative
O'Neill, general statute of limitations we look at for civil actions in the state of Minnesota is 6 years. Generally, you're looking at 6 years for being able to sue someone. So I think 5 years is even more restricted than that.
Good. Mr. Fan, were you standing there to say something? Or?
If I may just respond to two of the questions that Representative O'Neill asked, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. Go up to the microphone and identify yourself.
Thank you. Melissa Rafan here on behalf of MELC. Mr. Chair, the 2 points I wanted to make, and I'll take them in the order in which they were raised. The first is paid time off. Representative Lesh said that this bill is more restrictive, which actually does not make sense. My point was many employers offer paid time off and there is simply no provision. In the statute which addresses the paid time off. So to address Mr. Carlson's point, it appears that this is on top of paid time off that employers already give, which is very expensive, onerous, and does not achieve the purpose that they seek to pass the bill. The second is on the statute of limitations. It has been specifically recognized, Mr. Chair, in the context of employment claims that a short statute of limitation applies. And Representative Lesh's point that 6 years is the general statute of limitations does not apply in the employment context, and courts have repeatedly said for the purpose of preserving evidence they are short statutes of limitations, and we don't think that 5 years is appropriate.
Good. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Lesh, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll
take the vote.
Mr. Chair, if I could have the allegations regarding PTO addressed before I make, or are we short?
As you feel so moved.
I would love
Representative
to make that happen. Thank you.
Identify yourself again, Ms. Stratton, please.
My name is Lisa Stratton. I'm a lawyer and founder and executive director of Gender Justice. I just would point out that the intent of the bill is clearly that PTO counts in meeting the requirements in the bill. it's employer complies with this section if the employer has a policy that makes available an amount of sick and safe time at least equal to and can be used for the same purposes as the sick and safe leave.
Very good. Representative Blesch, anything
Thank you.
Else?
Ms. Chair, by way of closing comments, that's of course correct. When I brought this up in 2008, that was one of the first things that Representative Zellers asked me. Well, what about paid time off? What about folks that have that? Well, it was the intent back then that that's covered in. And during the drafting of these bills, it's our intent that that be covered in this as well. If, in fact, the language needs to be tweaked to make that clear, we'd be more than happy to. I don't think that that would satisfy the opponents who had testified, Mr. Chair, in that they testified in the same manner and using the same language when we expanded the ability of working families to use earned sick leave last year. But to the extent it brings anyone on board and a willing participant in the process, I'd be more than happy to have a conversation about that. But thank you. It's a good bill. Pass it.
With that, the chair renews this motion that House File 2461, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is off to your committee, Representative Blesch. Thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned.